And now, coming to you from the gleaming spires of Chicago, broadcasting throughout the multiverse, the Nine Realms, Niflheim, Svartalfheim, Olympus, Nidavellir, basically anywhere that has the internet, really, we proudly present Radio Free Asgard.
And hello, everybody, and welcome to Radio Free Asgard. This is episode number 200. My name is Tom Harris, and I'm your host of the only Thor podcast hosted by a true descendant of Odin. And here we are, coming to you from Chicago. Yeah, so episode 200, we made it. Wow. Think we'll make 300? Yeah, maybe. I think so. Yeah, we'll probably make 300. I don't know about 400, but, you know, we'll get there. We'll get there eventually. Anyway, so welcome along to the show. And it's been kind of a difficult time thinking about what to do for the special anniversary episode. We're right in the middle of a storyline, which has a couple of issues left. And I didn't want this just to be another issue. So once again, we're moving along in kind of a disjointed fashion. What a kind of a shambles of the last five episodes. Going back and forth between one thing and another. Yeah, it's not normally like this, folks. If you're listening and you're new to the show, we tend to stay on target, at least through a story arc, and not like this where we're jumping all over the place. So we do have something a little bit special planned. We're going to be talking a little bit about Avengers 2, and even though I think everybody has seen it, it's not going to be a spoiler-heavy discussion. There are going to be spoilers, but I think at this point everybody has seen the movie, or anybody who's going to see the movie has seen the movie. And if you haven't seen the movie, then go ahead and watch the film, probably on DVD by the time this show comes out, and then decide, you know, whether or not you're going to listen. But we're going to be talking a little bit about Avengers 2. And then we have two stories that we're going to cover. And the interesting thing about these stories is that neither one of them was published by Marvel Comics. So we're doing some stuff that's kind of out of the ordinary for our special episode. So I want to start out talking about Avengers 2. And I'm going to be talking about another movie as well. And that is Days of Future Past. Now, the reason I'm talking about it is because I think that it's a good comparison and contrast to Avengers 2. I think that Avengers did a lot of things well that Days of Future Past didn't. At the same time, I think there's some things that Days of Future Past did well that Avengers 2 didn't quite hit the mark on. And I will talk about that as we go. I recently saw Days of Future Past. As you know, if I don't see it in the theater when it first comes out, it means I never see it until it comes out on DVD. That's just the way it is with me. And Days of Future Past, you know, being one of the X-Men films, I'm not that big of a fan of. I'm not, of course, anymore. I'm not really collecting comics other than the Thors that I cover for the show. And Legion of Superheroes stuff if it comes out. But other than that, I really am not buying comics anymore. And I think you'll find that's true of a lot of podcasters who podcast about comics, is they're not buying a lot of the new stuff. So just be aware at any rate that I'm going to be comparing these two films at certain points. And interestingly enough, that's touched on in this next comment here, because, of course, we have a comment here from one of our listeners, that listener being Manuel Carmona, who's a friend of the show, longtime listener. And yes, Manuel, like you say in your message, I do hope to have you on the show again sometime not too far distant future, but it'll have to be after my vacation. Anyway, so Manuel had this to say about Avengers Age of Ultron. Avengers Age of Ultron was a great movie from start to finish. Literally, its action from the opening scene all the way through, with some great character moments throughout. I loved Black Widow's backstory as well as Hawkeye's. Scarlet Witch was a pleasant surprise for me, because I was hating her before watching the movie. Quicksilver was okay, but I enjoyed the X-Men Days of Future Past version better. Yeah, we're going to talk about that. Ultron is a chilling and cool villain. The one thing I was a bit disappointed with was that there was far less screen time for Thor on this one, although he has some of the coolest scenes. For example, the lifting of Mjolnir at the beginning, and at the end, let's just leave it at that. Oh, by the way, Vision rocked. Again, the movie is great, and even though some people might say that Age of Ultron isn't as epic as the first one, you're comparing it to the greatest superhero movie ever made, so not bad at all. Congrats on 200 episodes, and I'm honored to be your friend, Tom. Hopefully we'll be able to record another episode in the near future. It's been way too long. For Asgard, from Manuel. Yeah, you're welcome on the show anytime, Manuel. I guess it's just a matter of finding the just that right episode or the right issue or whatever that we're talking about. But you're always welcome on the show. You know that. So I'll start out by saying I liked Avengers 2 a lot. In fact, I thought it was better than the first one. I thought it was a lot better than the first one. There were some things script-wise that I thought really stood out with Avengers 2 that Avengers 1 kind of got bogged down on. In the first movie, you had them introducing the characters who hadn't had their own film yet, and that kind of went on a little bit too long. I think that there was a little bit of character stuff in the first Avengers that maybe wasn't needed. I like the banter. I like the camaraderie. I like a lot of the stuff. And you had that all in Avengers 2 as well. But in Avengers 1, they kind of had to set the scene, you know, the getting the team together. It's an origin story. So, you know, once you've got the team together, then you actually go off to confront the villain. In Avengers 2, you start out with a bang right from the beginning of the movie. You start out with the Avengers in battle, and you see every member of the team is prominent. Every member of the team is given more or less equal time on screen. And not that you should be thinking about these things while you're watching an action film, but I really noticed this fantastic job of editing from the very beginning, and this really determined effort to keep things equal between all the different characters. I liked that. It was something that was really strong there in the opening of the film. Now, correspondingly, in the script, they try to give everybody something to do. Now, keep in mind, we have a lot of characters here. We've got Captain America. We've got Iron Man. We've got the Hulk. We've got Hawkeye. We've got the Black Widow. We've got Thor. That's your core team. And in addition to that, we get the Scarlet Witch, Quicksilver, and the Vision. So Marvel has already introduced a great bunch of characters, and now they're introducing more on top of that. In this kind of situation, that could make the movie feel really top-heavy. To Marvel's credit, I think they managed to avoid that. Now, that's not to say that it was all perfect. I think there was some awkwardness in the way that they shoehorned the characters in. Now, the Vision, I think, had the best story arc, and that is because basically he was manufactured during the movie. And it all came to a satisfying head at the end. So I like the introduction of the Vision a lot. Now, the introduction of Quicksilver and the Scarlet Witch, on the other hand, a little bit clunkier. We just kind of had them there. I do like the fact that they introduced them ostensibly as villains, which goes right back to the way that those characters were originally introduced in the Marvel Universe in the 1960s. Of course, you know, they're substituting Ulysses Klaue for Magneto in this case, but that's okay. That works. And I think it's a cute nod to the past Marvel history as well. I think it's interesting that they don't have them using their powers or really explaining that much about them for a really good chunk of the movie. We get just kind of the most basic of descriptions. He's fast, she's weird. I would have liked to have seen more as far as establishing those characters. I never liked Quicksilver in Avengers 2. I didn't feel anything when he quote-unquote died. The reason I say quote-unquote is I don't think he's actually dead. And I didn't really care that much for the Scarlet Witch either. She had a little bit more of an arc than Quicksilver, but not much. And that bothered me a little bit. That's always going to be an issue with me, where you get a character that I just don't give a shit about, and then kill them off. I don't care. It doesn't have the impact for me. Days of Future Past, of course, has its own version of Quicksilver. Now, superficially, of course, the characters are very similar. They have the same hyperspeed type powers. In Days of Future Past, it's pretty clear that Quicksilver is a mutant. Not so clear in Avengers 2. Was delighted with the way they used Quicksilver in Days of Future Past. I was drawn to the character. The actor did a good enough job portraying him. It made me like the character. And when you consider he had very little screen time, that's quite a feat to accomplish. I think that was a combination of the way the script was written, the way they utilized Quicksilver, and the way they showed his power working was a lot cooler in Days of Future Past. In Avengers 2, he didn't really do much of anything. He was kind of boring. in Days of Future Past, they had Quicksilver doing this whole sort of time stop thing. They're showing his powers being used from his point of view and able to affect lots of things at once because he's moving really, really fast. And I liked that. I really liked Quicksilver in Days of Future Past. I think probably I liked him better than any other character in that film because of the way he was used. And I think that the Avengers really failed, really fell down on the job with Quicksilver. And it's kind of a shame. I don't imagine that they're planning on bringing him back. Who knows? I mean, I don't think he's dead. And, you know, there's a reason for that. And the reason is because he was shot in the beginning of the movie and it really didn't seem to bother him that much. I don't think that he was dead also for another reason, and that is that they brought him on the evacuation craft with them, which had limited space for people. I think that had he actually been dead, they wouldn't have bothered to bring the body along. So they didn't actually say he was dead, and there's reason to believe that he's not dead. So, you know, hopefully they can bring the guy from Days of Future Past in for Avengers 3 or whatever, and we can have Quicksilver again. I don't know about the character. I mean, they didn't have him be, you know, Pietro Maximoff in Days of Future Past. He was, you know, Pete Maximoff or whatever. And, you know, he really wasn't, you know, the same character. But, you know, they could get away with it maybe. I don't know. I like the character better anyway. As far as the Scarlet Witch goes, well, she's there for a reason. I'd like to say I like the character. She has an arc that is pretty shallow, but at least is somewhat interesting. And so I don't really have a lot to say else about her. Of the Avenger characters who they had their individual storylines and they tried to give everybody something to do, I felt like Avengers 2 kind of fell down on the job. They had good character development for Hawkeye with a secret family and all that stuff. They did some cool stuff with Iron Man. They did some cool stuff with Cap. You know, now they wouldn't have concentrated as much on those two because they've got their own movie franchises. And that's really where any really important character development is going to take place by necessity. You know, Thor, who's probably the least developed of those big characters, really didn't have that much to do in Avengers 2. And unfortunately, what he did have ended up on the cutting room floor. And that's a source of frustration because in the script, Thor has to go and speak to the Norns. And they give him information that's really important to the storyline. And of course, that ended up on the cutting room floor. Maybe it slowed down the rest of the story too much. I'm just hoping that is replaced in the DVD release. I think there's a lot of stuff that probably got cut that would make Avengers 2 even better. And I think it's a pretty good film to begin with. So I think that there's a lot that they can do to actually improve the film as far as including stuff that was cut out. And then there's the Hulk and Black Widow. I think that they got to a point where, okay, well, we have this big thing happening to Thor. We've got this happening with Iron Man. We've got this thing happening with Cap. What are we going to do with these two? Oh, well, why don't we have them fall in love? You know, because they didn't know what to do. So here you go. You have two characters you don't know what to do with. So make them fall in love with each other. And that's how it felt to me. I think it felt like a throwaway plot. And they could have, I understand, not everybody's storyline can carry as much weight. I get that, because if you did that, then you just have way too much going on and then the movie would get really messy. I don't have anything really against them being a couple, but I think that they took a really lazy way out and unsatisfying as far as that goes. And, you know, dollars to donuts, they're going to forget about it by the time Avengers 3. I don't even know if the Hulk is going to be in Avengers 3. I'm not sure that they're going to actually be able to go anywhere with it. And I'd be really surprised if they did, either in the comics or in the movies, because it seems like such an odd coupling. Yeah, I found that unsatisfying. Now, I like the Vision. I like the way they introduced him. You know, basically, he's constructed during the movie, and you get to see him, you know, from soup to nuts, the Vision becoming the Vision. Now, the fact that they have him as Jarvis, well, okay. I had a little bit of trouble with that because I didn't think of Jarvis in either of the Iron Man movies or in Avengers 1 as being particularly compelling. I would rather see Jarvis as a human butler, but that's the traditionalist in me coming out. I, you know, and to have Jarvis be the Vision, well, to me, it doesn't quite sit right. But at the same time, it doesn't really bother me in a way. I mean, like I said, it's the cinematic universe. It's kind of its own thing. Now, a lot has been made of the Vision being able to lift Thor's hammer. That doesn't bother me as much as it may bother some other people. And the reason why is, I think they actually touched on in the film, is that the Vision is a machine. And the other thing is, Vision isn't innocent. And I don't know that just being an innocent and not being tainted or whatever can make you worthy to lift Mjolnir. If Thor puts Mjolnir in an elevator, the elevator doesn't have any trouble lifting Mjolnir. And I kind of feel the same way about the Vision, okay? He's a machine, not necessarily worthy. I don't know if they ever had the Vision lifting the hammer in the comics. So, yeah, you know, I could be wrong, but I don't think he ever did. But it just seems to me that makes perfect sense that a machine should be able to do it. Unlike the Marvel Comics version of the Vision, the movie Vision is in no part human. And when I say no part human, he's not really a synthesoid. He's a robot. He's actually built of mechanical bits. You know, they have some biological elements to him, but he's not like the original Human Torch. He's not that kind of an android in the way that the comics Vision is. He's more mechanical than biological. And he's got a soul gem, which may cause him trouble later. I assume he'll be back for... Yeah, the Avengers 3. I like the way they introduced him. I like the fact that he's not pink the way a lot of the merchandise is. A lot of the merchandise of the Vision has this really horrible magenta pinky color to his skin. And he was much more the traditional red in the movie. So I liked that and wonder why they made him pink. So, yeah. And basically, I think Avengers 2 was a pretty fun romp. I think it was an entertaining film. I liked it. Liked it better than the first one. And I think that, you know, they've set themselves up reasonably well to go into the next part. Don't know what to think about Civil War. You know, I guess we'll find out. You know, we got Civil War coming up. And I think we're bound to see a little bit of the character arcs that started in this film continued on in that. And I'm assuming that we're going to see Ant-Man as well, because his movie is coming out even before that. Yeah, so basically that's what I think of Avengers 2. So I'm going to talk a little bit more about Days of Future Past, because I've just kind of referred to it in passing. Like I said, I thought that was also an entertaining film. But as with any time travel story, there's a lot of time travel type tropes. Let's try saying that three times fast, time travel type tropes. It's hard to avoid in a story like Days of Future Past. They obviously based it very heavily on the Claremont Burns story, but had to change all the characters around. One of the biggest problems I had with the movie was how they sent Wolverine back into the past. Kitty Pryde doesn't have that kind of a mental power. I suppose you could also argue that it neither did the person who did the transfer back in the original story as well. But they didn't explain the mechanism of this, you know, sending Wolverine's mind back in time. They really did a very poor job of explaining things and making it plausible. I like a lot of the actors in the film. I don't think they really needed the older Xavier and the older Magneto that much. That obviously, they don't really do that much. They're basically long cameos. For those of us who, you know, maybe did enjoy some of the earlier X-Men films, we get cameos from a bunch of the other actors, but they have less time on the screen than Richard Nixon does. If you're looking for those characters, it's not that exciting. We do get a little bit of play from, you know, Iceman, who was, you know, not very well utilized in the past, and we have, you know, a little bit of some of the other characters. But, you know, I think Storm, Cyclops, and Jean Grey were just horribly misused. I do like the way they utilized the Beast. I like the Beast from the past and how he was used as far as the character being able to change back and forth. That's something I've always thought that the Beast should be able to do. But obviously, in the comics universe, they disagree with me. So anyway, yeah, so I would give Avengers 2, I'm definitely going to give it an A-. I think that it doesn't really deserve an A+, because there's a little bit too much wrong with it for me, but it's definitely better than the first one, which I think I gave a B+. So this one is a little bit better than that. And Days of Future Past, I'm going to give it a C-. I think that by and large, despite some of the good acting, despite some of the character bits that were enjoyable, it's kind of a shallow movie. And again, being a confusing time travel story, it's not particularly well told. And yeah, let's just say I just don't care for it as much. And again, the X-Men franchise is not one that I jump up and go out to see in the theaters because I just don't care. All right, so I guess we're going to take a little bit of a break here, and then we're going to come back and we're going to talk about two stories from the golden age of comics. Before we do that, here's a message from one of our friends.
Here at Quark's, customer satisfaction is our primary concern.
I'd say we just found our way into a wormhole.
I'm Kira Norris.
Lieutenant Commander Worf, reporting for duty, sir.
You're the best crew any captain ever had. This may be the last time we're all together.
This will shortly become a leading center of commerce and of scientific exploration. For Starfleet, one of our most important posts.
It is quite simply, Commander. The journey you have always been destined to take.
Sensors are not functioning.
We've lost all contact with the space station.
The hell is happening out there?
Shields up. Damage report.
Battle stations.
I'm Captain Benjamin Sisko. Welcome to Deep Space Nine.
Listen to the prophets. A Deep Space Nine Two True Freaks presentation with Sean Engel and Andrew Layla.
And now with 100% more Paul Spataro.
And we're back. And definitely you guys should check out Listen to the Prophets. It's a good show. All right, so without any further ado, let's go ahead and move along to our review.
Cross the rainbow bridge of Asgard, where the booming heavens roar. You'll behold in breathless wonder the God of Thunder, mighty Thor.
And this week we are looking at perhaps the earliest version of Thor to appear in comics, going all the way back to June of 1942. Yeah, you knew it was coming, folks. This week we are covering the villain from Valhalla, the Sandman and Sandy story that appeared in Adventure Comics number 75. And we'll look at the rest of the issue here after we've covered this. But Adventure Comics at that time was an anthology title, and there's a lot of stuff in it. It's always interesting for me to look at these Golden Age comics because some of the stuff is really good. Now, some of the stuff is also not very good, as we'll find out. But we're really concerned with the Sandman and Sandy story from the issue, which was by Jack Kirby, who was the writer and the artist, and by Joe Simon, who for once was just the inker. So, yeah, Kirby took over the lead on this one. And we have The Sandman by Joe Simon and Jack Kirby. And we show on the cover page here, actually the cover of the issue, the cover of the comic actually shows Sandman and Sandy fighting against a Viking looking dude with a big red beard and a hammer. And he's got this really weirdly shaped leg. So, and then in the background, there's a Viking ship and a couple of, Vikings kind of hanging out there. And we open to the splash page of this story. It shows Sandman and Sandy in kind of could be a later part of the fight where the villain has grabbed Sandy by his hair. Ouch. And is kind of swinging him around by his hair and holding a hammer above his head, which is shooting out little lightning bolts. In the background, we have some cops, and they appear to be fighting against these guys who are dressed as Viking warriors. We get a little bit of exposition here. From the misty caverns of the past rises Thor, ancient god of war. No kindness pulses in his body. Instead, only hate and savage ruthlessness guide him as he invades a modern world. Wielding his magic hammer, he beats a mad tattoo upon the forces of society. Robbing, killing, plundering, he stalks invincible until Sandman and Sandy take up the challenge of the villain from Valhalla. And we cut to the beginning of the story here where we have Sandman and Sandy chilling out at, I guess, Sandman's house. I don't know. Does Sandy live with him? I'm not sure. It's one of those odd man-boy relationships that we have in 1940s comics. And they're reading a book. Apparently the book is called Twilight of the Gods. The book reads as follows here. And as the mighty Thor smote them with his magic hammer Mjolnir, because they misspelled it, the heavens resounded with deafening thunderclaps, while the mortal blow trembled the wrath of the warlord of Valhalla. And we have the Sandman here in his secret identity, and he's saying, "You haven't put that book down for hours, Sandy. It must be very interesting." "You said it, Wes." And the Sandman, as Wesley Dodds, is his secret identity. He looks at the pages, and he's like, "This Thor must have been a tough citizen."
"King of the gods, no less. Boy, could he do things with his magic hammer."
"Ooh, I bet he could."
"Yeah, he was no softy. If he were living today, I'd take a crack at him, hammer and all."
Yeah, tough talk from a little kid. And he then shifts scenes and says, "That night, into silent New York Harbor slips a strange craft. And it is a Viking-style ship. And the cops come running and there's a guy jumping out. He's dressed in Viking clothes and he's got a winged helmet. And he's carrying a hammer.
"Hey, you, what's his masquerade party?"
"Party? Party? What is this party?" "Out of my way, puny weakling."
And this character, who's I guess supposed to be Thor, whaps the policeman out of the way. And he goes on to terrorize New York City. After his savage attack on the policeman, the huge invader strolls down Broadway, taking in the sights. And there's people kind of walking in the middle of the street here. I guess that's just kind of a Jack Kirby thing, people walking in the middle of the street.
"I see it, but I don't believe it," says a guy.
And he is in front of a bank called the National Bank. And he says he hesitates as he passes the bank. And he takes his hammer and he smashes into the window with it. Throws the hammer in and it's making all this lightning.
"Ha ha! Nothing can stand against Mjolnir, the hammer of the gods. Now to get the gold these people keep in this strange stone house."
And he goes in there, but there's guards in there. And they start shooting their guns at him. And he's like, "We're hitting him, but he won't fall." And Thor takes his hammer and he smashes them aside.
"Rash mortals," he says. "The booty lies beyond this iron wall. But Mjolnir will shatter the stubborn barrier."
And he takes his hammer and he smashes the vault door. And he gets in and he's carrying these bags of gold and money out. And there's a police car approaching with the sirens blazing, and Thor's thinking to himself, a queer chariot that, but Mjolnir can overcome it. And he hurls his hammer at the cop car, utterly destroying it. So, you know, this is a pretty powerful hammer thing. Again, the mighty hammer is thrown, and again with the same devastating effect, and the car just kind of blows up, and the cops get blown up with it, I guess. I guess they're okay, because they're shooting at him now.
"Ho, ho, ho! What power!
The bullets won't hurt him!"
And they're shooting at him and having no effect. And we shift scenes back again to the harbor, and Thor has gone onto his boat, and says, "Other squads of police arrive. The Viking has already reached his ship and is setting sail."
"I think I'm dreaming. 'Tis impossible for a nightmare to raise Cain when you're awake."
And yeah, and so he gets away. Next day, stockholders of the raided bank hold a board meeting. Among them is Wes Dodds, a.k.a. the Sandman.
"Since the police can do nothing more, we'll have to write it off as a loss."
"I object," says Wes. "The marauder must be brought to justice." "Let's not count your losses yet. You forget there is still one force those raiders may still have to reckon with."
"The Sandman, eh? There may be a chance."
And we then shift scenes to Wes Dodd's house later that evening, and we see Sandman and Sandy dressing into their clothes. And this is back when Sandman was still wearing, he didn't have the gas mask outfit. He had this weird, in this case, it's yellow and red outfit, or gold and red outfit. And I don't think that's what he was wearing later. I think, doesn't he wearing yellow and purple? Yeah, anyway, this is wearing red and gold here.
"Wow, Thor, king of the Norse gods in the flesh," says Sandy.
"And with his magic hammer, don't forget that, so be careful."
"I will."
And the two of them go jumping off of a building and have no apparent means of support, leaping from one building to the next. There's not like a rope or anything. They're just kind of leaping from one building to the next. Anyway,
Sandman, look, says Sandy.
Great Scott, says Sandman. And they look down below and they see that Thor is back. And there's a big squadron of police that are attacking him, but he's easily dealing with the police, just knocking them all aside with Mjolnir, sending all these people flying. And Sandman charges in, and Thor says, ho-hee-ho-ha-ha. And of course, a good ho-hee-ho-ha-ha deserves a retort from Sandman. Wow, he threw the policeman with one hand. I'll knock you down. I'll have to, says Sandman, and goes thundering in and knocks Thor over. And the caption says the Sandman may well have butted a stone wall. Thor is more surprised than hurt, while the Sandman is unconscious. By thunder, this is fun, says Thor. And then, of course, Sandy has to have his say.
Hurt my pal, will ya?
And Sandy rushes on, determined to finish the Sandman's job, and leaps forward, and Thor just reaches out his leg and kicks him in the face with a pow and knocks him down.
Bothersome little gnat, says Thor,
and apparently gets away. And we then see a few minutes later, Sandman returns to consciousness, and he's like, oh, my head. And then he looks and he sees Sandy lying unconscious nearby.
Sandy! Sandy! If he's hurt that kid, I'll... Sandy! Speak to me! Are you all right? Sandy! Sandy! Why, he is hurt! His head! It's...
And he never finishes the sentence, and the next thing we see is ambulances arriving on the scene, and Sandy is being rushed to the hospital, and Sandman is there, and he just says, I'll even things up, Sandy! Enraged by his little pal's injury, the Sandman decides upon quick vengeance. And the Sandman's talking to the police here, but about seven cops here.
Listen to me, men.
The Sandman. Wonder what he wants, says the cop.
This battle's not over for me until it's won. That Norseman and his raiders must not have time to get away again. You'll have no time to wait for reinforcements. I'm going after them. Are you with me?
And the cops are like,
he's right. We got to head them off.
We're with ya! Let's go!
And we then shift scenes to the Viking ship. Little scene going on here.
Meanwhile, aboard the pirate longboat, the Norse god Thor divests himself of a transparent garment and speaks to one of his men.
Tell the boys to set sail for the hideout. We'll divvy up there.
Those lucite suits are pretty uncomfortable, eh, boss? The boys have took theirs off, too.
Lucite!
Steel as pliant as cloth. Boy, these may be uncomfortable. They're sure handy when the bulls start bouncing bullets off of you. After we dock, get the mob to change into their everyday clothes and scatter.
I get it, boss.
The bulls will be looking for Vikings, not mobsters. They'll never suspect us.
And so, we have Thor smoking a cigar here like a mobster.
But the Viking gang leader suddenly finds it's too late to carry out his plan. And for some reason, they're docked here.
I mean, like, people wouldn't notice the Viking ship there. Anyway, so Sandman and the bunch of cops are there.
Come on, men. We caught them just in time.
It's Sandman and the cops.
It's too late to put on our lucite suits, says Thor. We'll have to fight it out. Get set. Here they come.
And, yeah, the Vikings are waiting for them, and then the Sandman and the cops come swarming aboard, and Sandman punches Thor right in the face, and there's another one, another Viking swinging on a rope. This is by far the best page in the story, which we'll find out. I'll talk about it in a minute.
This is for Sandy, says Sandman, and is punching Thor.
And we have a fleet of police riot cars and motorcycles speeding hastily to the scene of action. And they have the cops rushing in, and we have reporters, and they're like,
what a battle. This will be the new scoop of the century.
And in the meantime, we shift to Sandy and in the hospital, and he's listening to the radio live as all this happens. Because, you know, in comics universe, things are simulcast as they happen. And Sandy has a bandage wrapped around his head, and he's rooting for Sandman and kicking the covers and kind of wrestling around in the bed for some reason. "Let him have it, Sandman," he says. And we basically don't see the battle because of these three panels of Sandy in the hospital. They have the radio announcer comes on. "The battle's over, folks. The beaten Norsemen are being taken into custody. Can see the Sandman now. Wow, he's dragging that big red-bearded Viking off the ship by the heels. Here's your gang leader, Chief Haynes, a clever and brutal killer." And the chief recognizes him.
"Well, well, if it isn't fairy tales, Fenton, you'd never know him under all this shrubbery. I know this hoodlum well. Used to be a professor of metallurgy or something before he turned to crime."
"Well, that explains those bulletproof clothes the gang wore." This is Sandman's looking at the hammer here. "This hammer is an electrical masterpiece. It can send enough voltage into the strongest steel to blow it to pieces." I guess he takes the hammer with him. I don't know. He doesn't really say. And it says his job done. The Sandman takes lightning measures to make a quick exit to nowhere. And the cops are trying to stop him. They're like,
"Hey, come back, you nervy rascal."
"Sorry, Chief. I'll return this bike to you soon. So long." Oh, so he steals the cop's motorcycle. Great. We then shift scenes to the hospital, and Wesley Dodds is visiting Sandy. And it's interesting. It says, "The next day, a new patient is brought to the hospital where Wes Dodds is visiting Sandy." And there's a new patient in Sandy's room, and the doctor is saying, "Queer case, that. Keeps having nightmares about Sandmen and such. Badly battered, too. Had to move him from a prison hospital." And Wes Dodds is like, "Nightmares about Sandmen? Prison hospital?
Say, that couldn't be. Or could it?"
And it is. It's Thor, and he's looks like he's got a broken arm, broken leg. He's got it's all bandaged up all over the place. And Wes Dodds is like, "It's Thor, by gosh. Straight from Valhalla to city hospitals."
"Why, it shatters my faith in fairy tales," says Sandy.
And that is the villain from Valhalla. You knew this story was coming eventually, didn't you? Anyway, so what to say about the story? Well, like a lot of other Golden Age stories, the writing and the art are not top-notch. This is obviously Simon and Kirby, but it is not Simon and Kirby at their very, very best. The artwork is uniformly awful. I mean, there are flashes here and there of what Kirby later became, but the stylistic touches, the layout, and the storytelling skill that Kirby became known for are almost completely absent here. In fact, if you didn't know it was Jack Kirby, you might think that it was some other artist. The story itself, it's very formulaic, but for the time, not too bad. I mean, it's not the perfect story, but you kind of wonder why they would have put a criminal in the same hospital room as a kid. I mean, it's just a little bit too coincidental that it happened to be Sandy at that, but you'd think that they would, he'd be guarded by cops and you have his own room so he doesn't get away. You would think, But again, it doesn't really match with what they need to happen at the end of the story here. Character of Sandman is just a grotesque character all the way through. Not really sure what Kirby was thinking here. Obviously, this is really early in his career. But Sandy is completely ineffectual. And I don't know if that was intentional or, I don't know, was Robin ever considered that much of a loser that he just charges in the battle and immediately gets knocked out? I don't know. I mean, maybe he was, maybe he wasn't. I'm not really sure. Coloring really weird. I do get the impression that Sandman is supposed to have a purple and yellow costume, but here, obviously, red and gold, like Sandy. Sandy was always red and gold, but I'm not sure that Sandman was supposed to be as well. So a little bit inconsistent here. Then again, they probably had a very limited color palette that they could use. Looking through the other stories, you can see that, blue, gold, red, and occasionally green, kind of a murky green, are the only colors that you really see. I mean, and you get a little bit of brown here and there, too. But these are not really colorful issues, and I gather it had a lot to do with the way that they had to color the comics because of what inks were available, and particularly during the war. We're going to see in the next story that the production values of 40s comics can be a whole lot better than this. All right, but because Adventure Comics is actually an anthology title, let's have a quick look at the rest of the issue. Not going to go into a lot of depth here, but there's some really good stuff in here. It's always fun to look at the ads, and of course we'll be covering the ads. Right inside the front cover, we have a Daisy air rifle ad, and they have like a cowboy one and a soldier one. And of course, this is the middle of World War II, and they're trying to get young boys to shoot a lot of guns because they never know if they're going to have to send them to war against Hitler. And one of the things I noticed about this issue is you really don't have a lot like with war bonds and that kind of thing. I mean, I know we've had that in some other stories that I've read from the Golden Age, and including the next story we're going to read has some stuff like that as well. But anyway, the issue opens up with a Starman story, The Case of the Luckless Liars. And this was written by Gardner Fox, and the artist was Jack Burnley. And I have to say, Jack Burnley is probably one of the great artists of the Golden Age. The artwork in this Starman story, absolutely phenomenal. It's far and above better than anything else in the issue. It looks photo-referenced. That's okay. I don't mind if somebody photo-references their artwork. It's a gorgeous, gorgeous story. Involves Ted Knight joining the Liars Club, and his lie that he tells everybody is that he is Starman. And of course, they would know that if they ever saw Starman, because Starman doesn't wear a mask. So anyway, so yeah, they definitely have a Clark Gable here being photo-referenced. And the Liars Club takes it upon themselves to tell stories about how they encountered Starman and how he killed them or knocked them out or whatever. And in the middle of all this, there's a crime, and so Ted Knight has to take off and go be Starman, and yeah. But again, like I said, the artwork really, really good, and you get some really dynamic action here for a Golden Age comic. Totally entertaining. I think it's a really, really fun story. Next up, we have The Manhunter. Again, this is Joe Simon and Jack Kirby. Manhunter being this guy wearing a blue and red outfit with a silver mask. A very creepy looking character. This time he's going up against like saboteurs or some such thing. I noticed a lot of people smoke in these issues. and I suppose that's true of a lot of 1940s comics. Kind of a generic story here of the Manhunter saving this woman who is trying to steal jewels from her. And it turns out that she's the jewel thief. So the Manhunter finds this out and tells a story. And then again, they're trying to capture her and knocks her out. Yeah, it's just kind of another formulaic Kirby story. Save bags from Popsicle, Creamsicle, and Fudgesicle and win prizes. So you win, save 100 bags from a Popsicle, and you can get all this cool stuff, a pocket knife, and it looks like hard to tell what that is. Oh, it's like cigarette lighter. So I'm not really sure. 200 bags, you get a chessboard and a baseball, a fountain pen, another like a Bowie knife sort of thing, a harmonica. 350 bags, you can get a basketball. Looks like a chemistry set, a stuffed Scotty dog, a dart board, and other worthless stuff. And if you want to, you can collect postage stamps, and you get a bunch of postage stamps for 100 bags. And they say, special note, the United States Defense Savings Stamps. Yeah. So, yeah, so I guess they do mention that. Next, we have the story of Steve Conrad Adventure by Jack Litte and Tarsi the Tiger Boy. So this is a kind of a ripoff of Jungle Book with more than a slight nod to Tarzan. And we have Tarsi the Jungle Boy coming in and being a hero and saving people from an evil leopard and an evil snake. Next, we have a story of the Shining Knight as the Shining Knight fights the Incredible Hulk. Well, it looks like the Incredible Hulk. It's a big green muscle guy, but no, he's called the Wrecker. And we have a weird story here where the Shining Knight gets struck by lightning and his weapon and armor lose their magic. But because Sir Justin is a brave soul, he goes off and fights the villain anyway. And at the end, everything is all back to normal. The villains in here, talking about racism here, 1940s racism is that the villains are these Japanese. I guess they're Japanese. I'm sure they must be. They're trying to hide in this old lighthouse, and they look a lot like monkeys. I mean, not a little like monkeys. They look exactly like monkeys. And anyway, so Shining Knight comes in, and he saves the day, and he raises his sword up to heaven, and they return his power to him, and that is that. Then we have an ad for Baby Ruth bars. 5 cents for a Baby Ruth bar, which is rich in dextrose, which is just sugar, which I guess we know. And Baby Ruth you can still get today, I think. I looked up this. There's an endorsement on this. Dr. Alan Roy Defoe. And the name sounded a little bit familiar, and I wasn't really sure. He says, Baby Ruth, being rich in dextrose, vital food, energy, sugar, and other palatable ingredients, makes a pleasant, wholesome candy for children. And I kind of got wondering as to what this guy actually did. And I find out this guy is a celebrity doctor from the 1940s. He became known as being the pediatrician for the Dione quintuplets. And, of course, that was big news back in the late 30s. And was kind of fired from taking care of the quintuplets because he was kind of a quack. And so apparently he hired himself out selling candy and shit and comic books to make a living. Next up, we have an Hourman adventure by Bernard Bailey. Very, very crude artwork. There's a character in here called Thorndike the Minuteman. And the less said about this story, the better. It really is a piece of shit. And I like Hourman, so it's kind of a pain. Then we have a little text piece, 2-page text piece. And these text pieces would run in all the comics back then because without them, they would not be able to get magazine postage status. And so that was really important for them. So, yeah, I didn't read the story because it didn't seem like it was going to be particularly interesting. And then we, of course, have the Sandman story that we just covered. And already in 1942, we have Muscle Magazine guys here. Free to men who want bomber power! And there's an invention called Quickie Jim, which is a couple of, looks like wire handles with a bunch of bungee cords attached, which they call triple strength progressive cables. And on the back cover, we have $7.20 worth of fireworks for only $3.59 from Polk, Ohio. Yeah, I don't even know where Polk, Ohio is, but I guess I'd never know. All right, and that's Adventure Comics number 75. So for part two of our special 200th episode, we have another story for you. This one may be not so well known as the villain from Valhalla. And I have many thanks to give here to Walt Grogan, friend of the show. Of course, Walt being the former co-host of the Chicago Geocacher podcast and a big fan of Captain Marvel. Shazam. And we are looking at Wiz Comics number 50. Wiz Comics, the comic book that sounds like you're taking a piss. Cover date of the comic is January 1944. Cover price, 10 cents. Once again, it's a 64-page anthology title. Cover art is by C.C. Beck, looks to be, and shows Captain Marvel wearing a barrel and nothing else. Yes, because he went skinny dipping and somebody stole his costume, and that is indeed what the story is about. Captain Marvel is running around naked trying to get his costume back. Now, what's interesting about that is that he changes back and forth between being Captain Marvel and Billy Batson. Billy Batson is wearing clothes, though, so you wonder why he's just not running around as Billy trying to get his costume back. But, you know, nobody said he had the wisdom of Solomon or anything, did they? Anyway, so, yeah, it's kind of an entertaining story. The Captain Marvel story is actually a lot of fun. And I have to say, it's, you know, this is being published by Fawcett. Fawcett, of course, was one of the big competitors to DC and Timely. And it's really easy to see why Fawcett did so well. Because really, the quality of the storytelling and all of the stories in this issue are head and shoulders above anything that we saw in that Adventure Comics issue, with the possible exception of the Starman story. The stories are well plotted, they're tight, and the artwork is uniformly really, really good. Now, unfortunately, unlike the Adventure Comics, we don't really have credits in the issue, so we don't know exactly who drew what. It's kind of unfortunate that the artists aren't getting credit. And, of course, I checked Mike's Amazing World of DC Comics, which is normally my go-to place for this kind of thing, and they didn't know who drew the stories either. I'm assuming C.C. Beck did the Captain Marvel stuff, because I think he did most of it, but you just don't know. And unlike sort of the crude drawings that we get in other Golden Age comics, the artwork here has a very clean line. It's cartoony, but realistic kind of at the same time, and really has a lot of charm to it. He draws a very realistic world. You have a lot of, the buildings look nice, the vehicles look nice, and while it may not be photorealistic, everybody is a caricature. I would say that that's probably a fair thing. The sense of storytelling and layout is just amazing all throughout. It's just a lot of fun to read. I mean, I think that it kind of explains the enduring popularity of the character. And basically the villains steal Captain Marvel's costume and Captain Marvel and Billy have to go running around to try to get it back. And eventually they do. Eventually they find the Captain Marvel's costume in the trunk of the villain's car. Interesting that Captain Marvel's costume is all one piece, including the cuffs and the belt and the cape. So it's just kind of floating around in one piece. Anyway, second story in the issue is a story of Golden Arrow. He's a Buffalo Bills Wild West show sort of character. Novelty archer. Obviously, is there some influence here for Green Arrow? I don't know if Green Arrow copied off him or whether he copied off Green Arrow. But it's basically a Western story. It takes place in the early 1900s, probably, and the Golden Arrow is just kind of a regular guy who can shoot arrows. And in this case, there's a hot air balloon show. And so he's shooting arrows at hot air balloons. So, yeah, what fun. But basically, it's a Western yarn with a bad guy. And, Golden Arrow has to go and save the day. Then we have the story of Spy Smasher. And Spy Smasher is this is just what he sounds like. He goes around and fights Nazis and Japs, and they're very much a World War II kind of character. And in the story, he's going up against the Mountain Menace of Horrido, who is a very grotesque looking, I think he's supposed to look like a sumo wrestler, but he's more muscular and not as bulky as a sumo wrestler. And he is disguised as an old wise man at the top of a mountain. And so Spy Smasher has to go and capture him and his evil Japanese minions. And he captures the hermit, quote unquote, at the top of the mountain and pulls his rubber mask off because rubber masks fool everyone. And he says, "A Jap spy posing as a hermit." And Horrido says, "Honorable curses." He goes to fight Spy Smasher. He's like, "Horrido, at your service. No, Yankee meddler. Honorable knife slices throat." And Spy Smasher says, "But honorable duck saves honorable neck. And now have honorable fist in dirty face." And yeah, so that's the kind of story it is. And, it's got turns and the Japanese are shown in here as having these filed sharp fangs. So, it's a World War II story. All right. So then we have our text piece, The Million Dollar Dog, a Wiki and O'Shaughnessy story. Yeah. Never heard of them. We then have Lance O'Casey in The Code of the Penguins. The less we talk about that story, the better. And then we have kind of a different kind of a story, a superhero comic, essentially an adventure comic. We have Richard Richard and the Cemetery Plot. So Richard Richard, of course, being a private dick, and involves Nazi war prisoners who escape from a prisoner of war camp and end up hiding in a cemetery, pretending to be ghosts and trying to scare people off. And what they end up doing is scaring ghosts. And the ghosts go and they get Richard Richard, private dick, and hire him to come and capture the evil Nazis. And of course, because the Nazis prisoners of war, they're actually wearing their Nazi uniforms. So apparently they don't change their clothes when they hold them in a prisoner of war camp. But, Richard Richard saves the day. And then we have the story that we're here to cover. This is a story of Ibis the Invincible. Now, Ibis is a character who's very much like Sargon the Sorcerer from the DC Universe. He's a magician. He wears a turban. He's got a girl sidekick. And basically, he does sort of magic-related mystery stories. And that's why we're actually looking at this particular one. And as is the case in a lot of these early stories, there are no credits whatsoever. But anyway, let's just move right on to the story here. We have Ibis the Invincible for centuries. The evil Loki lay imprisoned by the magic of the old gods, Thor and Woden. Cast out of Valhalla with his fierce pets, the Midgard Serpent and the ferocious Wolf Fenris. For centuries he brooded, hated, plotted. Then came the combination of accident and evil design to set him free with all of his terrible evil. It's not that terrible. And not even the mighty powers of Ibis, Prince of Magic, could stay. Loki the Terrible! And the sort of splash panel shows Loki, and he's this guy's kind of skinny, got white stringy hair and kind of snaggly teeth. He's got a evil-looking snake wrapped around his neck, and he's wearing this kind of Greek or Roman kind of skirt, kind of lace-up sandals, and he's got a wolf who looks kind of weird, is kind of hanging around with him. And we shift scenes, actually, to the beginning of the story here. We have an old prospector looking for gold in Alaska. He's on a dog sled, and he's like,
"Gotta make a strike this time. That glacier, sometimes they push gold pockets down from the mountain. I'll follow the foot of the glacier and... Now what are those fool dogs acting scared to death about?" And the dogs are going, "Ow, arf, arf, ow."
And the old prospector, suddenly looking much younger in this panel, sees a man, a snake, and a wolf frozen in the ice. And the dogs are going, ki-yee-yee-yee, ki-yee-yee-yee. And the prospector's like, "Brr, I'm getting out of here. He looks alive and bad. So bad I get a sick feeling in my stomach just looking at him." And then all of a sudden he's thinking, "I can't leave him there. Gotta chop him out. Take him to the post." And the caption says, "Helpless, frozen through untold centuries, yet Loki's evil brain can still dominate." So Loki is obviously influencing the guy to chop him out of the ice. And he chops the big block out of the ice with Loki and his snake and his dog out and takes it to the trading post of Sly Jake Gunn.
"They ought to be worth something to you, Jake. After all..."
"No, but because I like you, I'll grubstake you to another prospecting trip for him."
And the guy's thinking to himself,
"Some circus back in the States would pay a fortune for that cake of ice."
And we then shift to months later, where we have Ibis and his sidekick, whose name is not yet given. And she is saying,
"What troubles you, my prince? I have never seen you so disturbed."
And he's got this thing that looks like a tuning fork with a little triangle in the end, and he is like fire shooting out of it.
"I fear a terrible evil is among us. The Ibis stick has never been so urgent in its warnings." Ooh, an Ibis stick.
We then cut to the edge of the city where we have the sort of carnival sideshow kind of thing, and Loki and the Fenris and his serpent snake are... frozen in the ice, and people are paying money to come to see it. And as typical in this kind of situation, we have a kind of a carnival barker, and he's shouting out,
over here, only a dime, 10 cents, the tenth part of a dollar to see a Viking 1,000 years old.
And the people's like, quit shoving,
give me 2 tickets.
And these refrigerator pipes keep freezing day and night. Preserve these remarkable specimens for your edification.
And people are looking at him, and they're like,
looks like he's alive and waiting to break out, don't he? Brr, look at them eyes.
Show ends, and they clear the tent out.
Clear the tent, please, out of the way. A new performance will start in 15 minutes.
And there's a guy who's getting ready to leave, but sort of lightning bolts shoot out of the block of ice and hit him. And he's like,
oop, that feeling like someone else is running my brain. I want to leave, but I can't. I'm helpless. Some force is making me hide here. It's making me do something.
something terrible. And he's hiding behind like a cloth or, yeah, like a, yeah, I guess it's a cloth. And he's got this blue glow around him now.
I've got to smash that refrigerator. Let the ice melt. I've got to. Can't help myself.
While not far away, we have Ibis and his girl. I wish they would say her name so I know what to call her. The danger, whatever it is, grows acute. The Ibis stick is fairly pulling me toward it. I must go.
I will go with you, my prince. Together we can face any evil.
And apparently the Ibis stick renders him able to fly, because he kind of grabs the girl by the arm and they're going flying through the air.
I thought we had faced the worst evils before, but the Ibis stick has never been this disturbed before.
Why must there always be evil in a world so beautiful?
And they arrive at the circus, and Ibis says,
A circus? Unmerciful heaven! It is worse even than my most gruesome nightmare, Loki and his pets!
I do not understand.
We actually have some swearing going on in the issue. The kind of the roustabout is saying, Hey you, blip blip blip, gate crashers, come back and buy tickets.
Quick, there is not a moment to lose, says Ibis,
and they go sneaking off into the tent where the Loki block of ice is, and the guy has been brainwashed, is in there with a sledgehammer, he's about to smash the refrigeration tubes, and Ibis is like,
Stop, stop, you don't know what you're doing.
Huh? What? And the roustabout comes in and is like,
So, trying to bust up my exhibit, huh?
And he kind of whacks, looks like he's whacking Ibis with his cane or something. And Ibis is like,
the evil look has cast a spell on you.
And the guy's like, hey, let me go. I've got to smash that. Got to. And Ibis says,
I saved your exhibit. This man under an evil spell was about to smash the refrigerating machine and let the ice melt.
Yeah? What do you want to queer my pitch for? What's he got against my Viking show?
That is no Viking, but the Norse god of evil, Loki, with his fierce pets. Ages ago, he was cast out of Valhalla.
Say, bud, you're all right. Loki, eh? Wow, what a spiel. I'll get new banners painted.
You mustn't, says Ibis. You must dispose of this at once. Send it back to the far north. If Loki escapes his ancient prison...
Send this back? You nuts, pal. I'll clean up a fortune.
Then I must try to destroy his evil with the Ibis stick.
Listen, screwball, you ain't destroying nothing but my patience.
And it looks like the guy's going to whack Ibis with his cane, and there's some sort of magic coming out of the Ibis stick.
My prince, look out!
The roustabout punches Ibis in the face. It's like,
this'll fix you, crackpot, and socks him, and she's like,
my prince!
And then the guy who was trying to smash the refrigerator, he picks up the sledgehammer again. And he's thinking to himself,
must free him. Must help myself. Must free him quickly. My prince, are you hurt?
And Ibis is down the ground.
If he's yours, lady, you better get out of here before, what's that?
And there's a big explosion. And Loki is free.
It is done. The evil one is here, says Ibis.
Further... It's alive!
I had to do it, says the guy with the sledgehammer. Something made me.
You shudder, Ibis, my ancient enemy.
And he casts a spell or something, and the Ibis stick is gone. And Ibis, is because he has to speak the obvious, he says,
The Ibis stick, it is gone.
What difference? I have had centuries in which to think to perfect my magic. Not even the Ibis stick can defeat me now. I don't get this, chum, but you ain't walking out on my show. Jormungand, my serpent of Midgard, silence this yapping fool.
And the snake is reaching out to the guy, and Ibis is like, no!
Fenris, my wolf, destroy Ibis, but save his princess. She will rule the universe as my queen.
Without the Ibis stick, I am powerless against this monster.
That beast...
And the snake has wrapped itself around the roustabout, and the dog is just kind of rearing up threateningly and not really doing much else. And we then see a next panel. Loki is trying to take the princess away.
My spell will make you forget him.
Never, my prince!
And at that point, Fenris jumps on Ibis. falls over, gets knocked down by Fenris, and his hand just happens to land on the Ibis stick. Ibis is like, "It is the end." "No, the Ibis stick. It flew back here." And he has his stick back, so he's like, "Ibis stick, destroy these foul horrors. Consume them in the everlasting flame." The dog and the snake catch on fire, and yeah, that's not very nice. And Loki's like, "Curses! Back, Fenris! He cannot destroy us, nor with that stick can we destroy him." And the snake and the dog return back to Loki, and Loki calls upon his evil magic, according to the caption here. And he still has the girl, and they disappear. And Loki's like, "We go, and with us goes his beautiful princess." And she's like, "No." "Gone. He has taken my Taya to some secret abode of evil." Okay, so her name is Taya. "And not even my magic is powerful enough to destroy him. Ibis stick, take me to my princess. I must save her, even at the cost of my own life." And it's kind of flaming, this weird flame, and he goes flying away again. He looks so weird when he flies. Obviously it's not superhero-like flying. It's more like guy wearing a suit and a turban flying. As he ends up at this Tower of Evil, which apparently has lasted all these thousands of years. "His Tower of Evil. My princess must be far up at its top. Ibis stick, make me a cloud to drift in her window." And we shift to the inside of the tower, where we have Loki, and he's doing this sort of claw thing with his arms like a Tyrannosaurus, and the princess is like, "Back, fiend! You will never conquer my heart! I can never belong to any but my prince!"
"Ha ha! But Ibis is powerless to defeat my magic. He cannot even reach us past Fenris and Jormungand."
And he casts some sort of a lightning or energy spell at Princess Taya. And he's like,
"You forget, Ibis. You love only me."
"No, no, help me, O prince. My will is weakening before his magic."
And all of a sudden, Ibis appears in a puff of cloud here.
"I hear an answer, my princess."
"Ibis, you arrived. But only to your doom. You cannot destroy me, but I can gather forces to overcome you."
"True. I cannot defeat you, but there is one who can."
And the stick is glowing really, really bright. And he's like,
"What? Who?" "Mighty Thor, ancient god of thunder, hear me. You defeated Loki once. Come and destroy his evil power forever." "No, not that one. Ah!"
And Thor appears in the room, and Thor is a Viking-looking dude. Doesn't look a lot like the villain from Valhalla, which is only a few years earlier. Is a muscular guy with a white beard and long hair. He's got kind of a Thor-like helmet, but it's got little lightning bolts on the side instead of wings. And like Loki, he's wearing a skirt, like a Grecian-style skirt. And Mjolnir is more like a sledgehammer here. And Thor appears in a puff of red smoke. He's like,
"Who summons Thor from Loki? You free from the spell of Woden?"
"Back, blusterer. You overthrew me once, but I have had the centuries in which to gather strength."
"This time, Mjolnir, my mighty hammer, will crush your evil forever."
"Gird me, O evil forces. Shield me with an armor the hammerer cannot pierce."
And Thor's like, "Strike, Mjolnir!" And the hammer breaks through the shield and hits Loki right in the chest. And the princess is like,
"Look, the hammer was stronger than Loki's shield."
"Aye, defeated again," says Loki.
And we see Thor is chasing Loki back into his magical dimension or whatever it is.
"See, Thor is driving the defeated Loki back to his magical prison.
The whole earth rocks at the mighty force of Thor's hammer."
And the two of them are up on some kind of cloud, and there's the dog and the snake are with them too. And there's a little lightning burst going off. And then a rainbow appears, and the rainbow is the sign of good.
"So they are gone. So is evil driven from the earth once more," says Ibis.
"But look, my prince, the bow of promise.
It is a token of triumph of good over evil, the promise that good lives on while evil perishes."
"Such good as you bring to the world will never die, my prince, says Taya.
And that is Ibis the Invincible in his story featuring the evil Loki. And the story ends actually with a one panel of Captain Marvel listening to the radio.
Flash, Hitler says his Fortress Europa can never be conquered, but the Allies will do it, and soon.
But it means tanks, planes, and guns, says Captain Marvel, and that means war bombs and stamps. Well, Americans, it's up to you.
And that is Wiz Comics number 50. Yeah, so, it's a really poorly written story. Really super melodramatic. Artwork is rather clumsy and stiff. Obviously, they have no grasp of Norse mythology whatsoever. I like the fact that they call the hammer Mjolnir. Actually, I was just going to point out, it looks as though they spelled it correctly originally. And then during the copy editing stage, at some point, somebody decided nobody could be able to pronounce that word. It begins with MJ. And they whited out the J's. So it says Mjolnir, but there's a space there. Yeah, kind of a dumb story, but hey, what do you expect from 1944, right? All right, and with that, it's time to wrap up the show. You know, sorry, folks, didn't have anything too incredibly special going on here, but at least we had some fun from the golden age of comics as in our 200th issue, and we got to talk about some movies as well. So before we do our normal log off, I just wanted to say a few words here. It's been 200 episodes, and we've had, I think, 200 pretty decent episodes. Some have not been as successful as others, but by and large, I think we've had a really good 200 episode run, and I look forward to many, many, many more episodes with all of you. I cannot express my appreciation enough because I couldn't have done any of this without you guys. Knowing that you guys are out there listening, getting the occasional email, getting the participation in the Facebook group, this is as much your show as it is mine, even though sounds most of the time like I'm the only voice on it. But, you know, there's always people out there who have influenced the show, always people out there who I have in mind when I record. And I'm always thinking about, you know, new stuff to do, you know, what's coming next. And, you know, without all of you out there, you know, none of this would be possible. Big shout out here to Paul Schweikart, who helped me come up with the show, to Ross Patzelt, who helped me a lot with, you know, when I first started podcasting especially, but even with Radio Free Asgard in the beginning, kind of kicking around ideas for the opening and that kind of thing, to all the people who I've met, who, you know, are personal friends of mine who are listening to the show, and to new friends like Manuel and the Yugi Works and Chris Bendorf, and, you know, all of you out there who are out there pushing for the show, you know, I really, really do appreciate it. And with that, we're back over the Rainbow Bridge, back to Midgard, and we'll see you next time here on Radio Free Asgard. You have been listening to Radio Free Asgard, a production of Tom Harris USA Productions, which is totally responsible for its content. The Mighty Thor and all associated characters are mostly copyright Marvel Comics. The stories presented are done so for educational, review, and entertainment purposes only. No ownership is implied. The silly voices, however, well, they're all me. Musical selections from Eden, the Invincible Sword of the Elfsmith, are copyright Mots Vent and are used with permission. If you like what you've heard on the show, we hope you'll leave us a review on iTunes, tell your friends, or even join our Facebook group. We really love hearing from our listeners, and we appreciate all of your support. Thanks once again very much for listening to Radio Free Asgard.